Hey everybody, this is Michael Collins. This is the Lunchtime Learning with Flying for the month of March. We're going to talk about retirement rules of thumb. Anybody been able to get in this morning?
This is Sherry from Portage County.
Welcome.
Here's Cody on.
Linda in Douglas County is here too.
Carol in Ozaukee.
Barb and Phillips.
Marilyn and Burnett.
Great. Well, welcome, everyone. I'll first apologize. I was a dentist this morning and had some Novocaine. So if I sound like I'm tipsy, it's just the Novocaine. Don't be alarmed. It might be a more exciting topic if I really were tipsy, but I'm just at half my face numb. So hopefully it'll wear off over the course of the call. So again, welcome everybody. This is the March Lunchtime Learning on Retirement Rules of Thumb. On the website fyi.uwex.edu/financial series, you'll find the primary item right there is a link called Retirement Rules of Thumb. And in that link, there's a little green box with a underscored Retirement Rules of Thumb in blue. And that, if you click on that, it brings up a PDF file, which is about a 4-page document, and that's primarily what I'm going to go over today, is this 4-page rules of thumb document. However, I also recognize this is probably a hot topic, given the current debates at the state and national level. So I always leave time on these calls for your questions and discussions, but I'll leave some extra time today because I think rules of thumb are really important, and I hope that this document is useful to you in your educational efforts, but I also know there's a lot of details that people are worried about right now. I'm happy to talk about those too. The other item that's on the website is a link for an article from the Wall Street Journal. So it's just a link to the website version of the article. But I thought it was interesting because it's an article that was about a month ago. Every Saturday they do a personal journal. They talk about personal finance issues as opposed to the 5 days a week when they talk about more Wall Street kind of stuff. And it talks about how boomers are beginning to retire. This is our first generation of retirees, really, who have primarily relied on their own personal defined contribution plans, 401k plans. And we're learning just how challenging that is for some people, how they didn't save enough or they invested in assets that didn't perform the way they thought or that are down right when they're getting ready for retirement. So I think it's an interesting article for background. It may hit home for those of you who maybe have a spouse who's in a 401k plan. But I also think it's a good example of why these rules of thumb are so prevalent, because this is how we primarily make our financial decisions. It's even how financial advisors oftentimes primarily behave, is on rules of thumb. We can come up with some pretty elaborate rules or calculations or portfolios to model. You know, if you talk to a professional advisor, they'll do Monte Carlo simulations of, you know, tens of thousands of different outcomes that can happen as you age and how much money you might need if the market does this or that or those kinds of things. But in the end, most normal people out there are just using rules of thumb. And rules of thumb are how we make a lot of decisions. We use rules of thumb for decisions about what we do every day, whether it's how much time to put into some activity or issues around exercise and nutrition or time with family, all kinds of things. We sort of make these simple rules that help us make decisions. And I guess evolutionarily, that's a good thing. It's something that's served us well and doesn't require a huge cognitive effort to make a decision. We can quickly make a choice based on some simple kind of rule. The good thing about rules of thumb is that they're, tried and true. And a rule of thumb is easy to use, easy to make a decision with, and most of the time it puts you in the right direction. It's not precise. It's sort of the shotgun approach to decision-making tools. We're just going to sort of get you in the right general direction, but we may not exactly hit the bullseye. But for most people, particularly in something like retirement rules of thumb are a really good starting point. And if you're doing education around retirement or savings, rules of thumb are something that everybody can get their head around. They're not too much bogged down in the mumbo-jumbo or the numeracy or the other things that people get stuck in. And so I think they're a useful teaching tool. They're a useful hook to get people maybe engaged to go to the next level. And for a lot of people, that's all they need. They, you know, probably 80% of people don't need much more beyond rules of thumb, don't need anything much more technical than that. So I would argue rules of thumb are in general a good thing for us as humans to survive, but especially in this area where I think the problem with many financial decisions is that people are just scared off. And, you know, but by virtue of having anxiety about financial issues, they do nothing. And that's the one thing we know is bad. So it's better to have general direction that's in a positive direction than doing nothing at all. So any questions before I launch into each of these rules of thumb? And I guess I will just quickly say that there is a building box. Remember, we do lunchtime learning every month on sort of a topic du jour. And then building box is where we cycle through the same 9 topics. There is a building box topic that comes up not in April, where we talk about retirement specifically. So this isn't meant to replace that in any way. In fact, I would say part of that module is about how you teach and what you teach. And really all I'm trying to get across with this particular brief and this particular topic is just this idea of using rules of thumb. And, you know, do those rules of thumb really hold up? So it's more specific than the discussion that will take place on that building box call. And again, a reminder that everything here is archived. So this call will be archived and the building box call. So if you're not able to attend that call, you can always listen to it later on. All right, so the 4-page brief lays out about 7 different rules of thumb. And some of these are more rules than others. Some of these, I would say, are more just slogans. But still, I'll sort of break these into 7 chunks, and we can talk through them one by one. And you can think about to the extent that they might be useful in what you're doing. And I would never say that you would ever want to present all 7 of these to any given audience. You'd probably just present a couple of these, or maybe just one of these. What I've done here is try to outline the rules of thumb that we see currently used quite frequently in the press or amongst the financial planning industry. And also I tried to spend some time really looking at, you know, are those rules of thumb valid? And given what we know from the research, are they valid? So we'll go from there. So the first one here is about you should save for retirement first, then pay off credit cards, and then put aside money for emergencies. And the logic to this rule of thumb, so this is the save first rule of thumb, even before other things that you might think are pretty important. The logic of this is that credit cards and even emergencies are all short-term things. And retirement is a long-term thing that benefits from the compounding of interest. So we want to take advantage of that compounding of interest and make sure we set aside money for the future first, even if that means having more debt today or not being prepared for an emergency today. This is something you'll sometimes, I mean, I think probably in the 2000s before the crash, we heard this a lot more because people were probably overly optimistic about the future and that they'd always have the ability to pay off the debt whenever they wanted to. And emergency? Who has an emergency? Whoever has a job and income. So I would argue that many consumers and the media have become a little more cautious regarding this particular one. But there is something truthful in this, is that you don't want to feel like you always have some other priority than saving for retirement, because if that's true, you'll never get around to saving for retirement. It's such a long-term payoff that it's easy to just focus on the present and not focus at all on the future, and that's obviously detrimental. So I think there is something underlying in this, which is partly true. Now, would I argue that it's a good idea to put money in a retirement account that may, if you're lucky, pay 5, 6, 7%? Let's say you have a really great investment opportunity that pays 10% in return. is that a better deal than paying off a credit card with a 20% annual APR? No. You're always better off to pay off high cost credit card debt. There is no investment that I can point to right now that's going to give you a better return than paying off a 20% annual percentage rate credit card or loan. So it's always a good idea to pay that stuff off. And certainly, if you were to save for retirement, earning 10%, and that savings for retirement put such a strain on you that the only way to get by was to continue to add to credit card debt, then that's even a worst-case scenario. So we don't want to encourage people to borrow today so just so they can save for tomorrow. There's no scenario under which that makes sense, particularly when you're talking about high-cost credit card debt. You know, I think there is one area where it makes sense, perhaps, to not focus as much on paying off debt as saving for retirement, and that's if you get an employer match. So in a company that has a 401k and the employer matches dollar for dollar, even 50 cents on the dollar, that's an immediate return. You know, immediately getting 50% or 100% matched, and that's hard to beat. In that case, it makes sense to save up to the point where you maximize your employer match and then turn to paying off high-cost debt. But that's probably the one case would argue that's the case. What in practice a lot of people end up doing is a little bit of all of these. So they try to cut their budget down so they can save, they can pay off debt, and also save up a little bit of an emergency cushion. The emergency cushion for learning is a very important and undervalued part of most consumers' balance sheet. The ability to weather a 2 or 3 month setback or a big expense like a car repair, home repair, are really important. That rainy day fund or precautionary savings is what prevents people from needing to use high-cost credit, prevents them from cashing out their retirement funds. We've seen a lot of hardship withdrawals in the last few years where people have cashed out their retirement funds, which involves a penalty and taxes. And it's a very high-cost way to find short-term liquidity. So I think the savings for emergencies is an important one. But again, you can do a little bit of each. You can put, I talk a little bit in the brief here about a 1/3 strategy. Put money towards high cost debt, put money towards savings, and put money towards your emergency fund. And once you want to focus your energy on paying off the high cost debt first, and then putting money in the emergency fund, and then focus your efforts on savings. But you can do all three at the same time. I think where this is particularly useful is right now as people are getting tax refunds. We've heard a number of cases of people at volunteer income tax sites, at VITA sites, who are getting tax refunds of $4,000 or $5,000 this year because of some increases in the way the tax credits are calculated. And so you can imagine that same rule would apply here too. So use some of it to pay off some debt, use some of it to set up some emergency savings, and even use some of it for retirement savings, which I know for a lot of low-income populations, this is not in their current choice set. They're not thinking about retirement savings. But there are some tools out there like the Savers Credit, which can provide them strong incentives, strong tax incentives to get even larger tax refunds if they put money into a retirement account. So other people, maybe outside of the tax setting, you think about bonuses or raises to the extent that anybody's getting them these days. Those could be another opportunity to think about this strategy. So I'll pause and see if anybody has any questions, and I'll go on to the next one. Okay, so the next one is a very classic rule of thumb. Take your gross income, so that's your pre-tax income. That's how much your hiring letter says before all the deductions and everything else are taken out. Multiply that by 10, by 0.1, and that's how much you should save every year. In fact, if you're in Wisconsin and the employee trust funds account, essentially what you get, 10% of your gross income, or close to that. Oftentimes, many retirement plans are set up that way so that the 401k match is designed that you put in some and the employer puts in some, and then once we get to 10%, You can continue to put in a little bit, but you no longer get the match after that point. So there's just sort of, there's something magical about this 10% rule that seems out there, that seems to make sense. And what's interesting is I'm pretty certain that 10% was pulled out of a hat. I'm pretty sure that when these numbers were thrown around, it wasn't, based on some, accountant who sat down and thought about all the different Monte Carlo simulations we can come up with households out there. It was just a nice round number that seemed reasonable. But it's kind of right, particularly for somebody who is earlier in their career. A 10% savings rate is not bad. 10% of gross income is not bad, especially if you think about the role that Social Security plays. If you're paying FICA into Social Security and you're eligible for Social Security old age insurance, that'll do about a, as we've talked on other WISP lines before, probably a 20 to 30% income replacement. And, you know, that the 10% rule will create a nest egg that might get you up to about 80% income replacement, which is what most people, sort of think of the minimum for retirement, replacing 80% of your income, in retirement. So between Social Security and the 10% rule, you might have enough of a nest egg to make that happen. Now, notice I said for younger workers, if you're talking about people in their 40s or 50s who don't have an existing savings, they don't have any pension, they don't have any 401k build up, all they're relying on is that potential Social Security annuity value, 10% is going to fall short. And 20% is probably the better number in that case, 20% of gross income. And it should be noted that these strategies are both the 10% and the 20% rule, based on age, are grounded in the idea that you're going to invest in something that's going to have a positive return, beats inflation, which means equities, which means stocks and bonds, and or stocks particularly. And there's some risk there. So, you know, these formulas are based on taking some risk, not taking on just putting all your money into bonds or something very low risk. This rule of thumb is also, it was developed with the expectation of inflation being relatively low. So in the days of the 80s when you had, 15-16% inflation, this, really breakneck inflation rate, this strategy would probably be too low. So assuming some willingness to put money into the stock market and take some risk, and assuming that inflation remains modest, remains sort of normal or average, this is probably a pretty good strategy. And what I love about this one is it's very easy to do the math. It's very easy to talk to somebody who's 25 who's making $40,000 a year, and you should be saving $4,000 a year. Are you doing it or not? It's a very simple way to help people begin to think about if they're setting aside enough or not. I'd say the last thing that's important about this strategy is you can't save on one side of your balance sheet and borrow on the other. So if somebody is saving 10% but then borrowing particularly high-cost debt like credit card or other debt, that doesn't make a lot of sense. So it's not a rule you can just blindly follow. You do have to look at whether people are so stretched in their spending that they're racking up debt that's high-cost on the other side. So that's an important factor to think about. All right, any questions on that one? Okay, so the next one is, there's a number of these rules of thumb that are out there. I call them nest egg rules. It's the classic question of how much should I save? This is in some ways, sort of an academic exercise. Academics always want to know if people know how much they need to have saved in the future. If you ask most people how much they're saving today, they can answer that question. But if you ask them, 25 years from now when you retire at age 68 or 69, how much money do you need to have in the bank at that time? Most people can't answer that question. It's not a bad thing to go through that exercise of thinking about how much I should have saved. What's my goal? What's the level at which I want to get to? But most people think more in today. How much am I sacrificing today? And less about what's going to be in the future. But I think it's important to think about that. What is the goal? What's the number? And so this rule of thumb about your net worth is a simple way to get there. And it acknowledges that your net worth is going to grow as you get older. So the net worth should be equal to your age times your pre-tax income, in other words, your gross income, same thing we talked about in the last example, divided by 10. So the example I gave here is if you're 40 and you have $100,000 in income, you should be so lucky. And I only chose that because the math was easy. And your net worth would be $400,000. So it's 40, your age, times 100,000, which is your income, divided by 10. And net worth here, we're talking about all forms of assets. So it might include home equity. It might include retirement accounts, businesses, investments, not personal property. And I probably wouldn't include jewelry or furniture or that kind of stuff. But, stuff that has some value and could be sold, like real estate or businesses. And then you have to subtract off the debt. So for most people, that's mortgage debt, probably some credit card debt and other debt. This is a nice rule of thumb because it does include both sides of the balance sheet. It's one of the things I like about it. And it's also indexed by age. So the older you are, the larger the numbers will be. It also is indexed by income. The more you make, the larger the number will be. So it has some nice features to it in terms of being relatively easy to use. And it gets people starting to think about a number. What's, probably alarming for most people is they do this calculation. They're not nowhere near. So I think it's a useful tool in an educational setting to get people to realize, oh, maybe that $4,000 a year I'm putting away isn't enough. I need to put more. So I think it can be important sort of conversation starter from that standpoint. It is a benchmark, and most people are going to be under the benchmark. Some will be over, and I don't think we want to argue that, oh, they should take on more debt or they should save less. I think that's when you have a conversation about, well, it's good because you're protecting yourself from particularly a downturn in the real estate market or the equities market or inflation, some other kinds of things like that. So, again, it just helps people start the conversation as opposed to giving them a hard and fast rule. The other thing that's important about this rule of thumb is it assumes that home equity is something you could convert into money. And a lot of people aren't willing to do that. Certainly with home equity conversion motors or mortgages or reverse mortgages, you have the ability to tap some of that equity. But liquidating the house is a tough way to come up with retirement income other than those kinds of loans. The other thing I would say about these rules of thumb about nest eggs is parents who are thinking about college for their kids, say they have two kids who are in middle school and they're thinking in the next 5-6 years they're going to have to start spending money on college. In that case, they're going through a really different kind of calculation because they're thinking not only about their savings for these retirement accounts, but also savings for college tuition. What's it going to be in and out of their balance sheet in the next 10 years? So that's an important thing for those families to think about is that, maybe it makes sense to have lower levels of savings that are available for retirement because you want to put more money into the college savings side. So that'll be an important group to think about if you approach this topic. Okay, any questions on this one? All right, here's another simple one that we see a lot sort of thrown around in the media. And that's you should save 12 times your current income. Again, this is one of those nest egg rules. If you're age 65 and you have $100,000 in income, you would need $1.2 million saved. Where this one comes in is thinking about how much you're going to spend in retirement. And so this particular rule of thumb is based on the assumption that you're going to spend 5% of how much you have saved each year while you're in retirement. So if you retire at age 65, you have $1.2 million, you're going to spend 5% of that every year. So roughly $60,000 the first year. This, in theory, would create, in combination with Social Security old age benefits, would replace about 80% of your pre-retirement income. So give you 80 cents on the dollar to survive in retirement. What doesn't work about this is that this assumption that your expenses are going to drop in retirement oftentimes isn't true. In fact, the first few years of retirement, many people find that their expenses rise because they're doing stuff they want to do, like travel or hobbies. And while they may not be spending money on commuting, they may be spending more time eating out and other expensive things. Also, as people age, healthcare becomes more of a cost. Even if you have generous coverage, there's still costs to healthcare that aren't covered. And those oftentimes can eat up a lot of that 80% income replacement. So many financial planners today say that 80% income replacement is insufficient, and you actually need to be closer to 100% income replacement. I think the jury's out on that a little bit. I think, you know, certainly it's a matter of what people's expectations are. A lot of it has to do with how old they are when they retire. People who retire early need to be prepared for a more austere lifestyle than perhaps they would be if they didn't retire early. People who retire later may not be as active, but they may have higher medical expenses. So there's both issues to think about. And certainly this interplay of medical expenses in retirement is one that I think financial planners are only beginning to think more about. The reality is that medical costs, whether it's uncovered medications or other copays, those kinds of things, they're growing much faster than inflation. So it would make sense that we might need to start saving more in retirement for those kinds of expenses. One thing I talked about just briefly about in this, I think one sentence is brief, is about expectations of inheritances. One of the mistakes that financial planners oftentimes will talk about is that people come into their office, talk about retirement, they're grossly undersaving for retirement. And the reason why is because they expect their, mom and dad or grandma or whoever it is that has some nest egg, or at least perceived nest egg, is going to be able to leave them a chunk of money. And oftentimes that strategy doesn't work very well. You probably know people who've been in this situation, in part because people live longer than expected, so they use more of their nest egg, and there's less to then inherit, and less for the heirs to divvy up. And partly as people get older, is the cost of living, particularly if you're talking about somebody who has to go in independent living or some kind of assisted care situation. Assets, even big assets, disappear pretty quickly. Add to that that there is always, the divvying up of inheritances in and of itself is not entirely efficient. So it's not like every dollar is going to pass through to the heirs. And so people tend to overestimate how much they might get inheritances, and that results in them saving less, being less prepared for retirement. So in this goal, it's important for people to, when they think about how much they have saved, think about actual dollars saved, not expectations of potential inheritances. On to the next one, unless somebody has any questions on the 12 times your income rule. All right, so the next rule of thumb is very similar to the 12 times your current income, but it recognizes this flaw in that income and expenses aren't necessarily the same, that your expenses in retirement are probably what you're more worried about as opposed to your income before you retire. So this rule says save 20 times your expected annual expenses the first year of your retirement. So the first year of retirement is probably your most expensive year. It's the year you're going to be most active. Maybe not on the medical side, but at least on the other side. So this then says don't think about how much you make, but how much you want to spend that first year out, and then multiply it by 20, thinking that you would live another, say if you're 65 when you retire, live to be 85. Other times it's multiplied by 25. Thinking you might live longer than that. Men might want to do different than women. Might depend upon life expectancy, how long your relatives have lived, your health status, those kinds of things. I think the 20 times is probably sufficient for most folks. That would include some expectation about pension and Social Security. Obviously, anybody can look up their expectation about Social Security from the Social Security website. They have a calculator on there that tells you, based on your current earnings, how much you'll get. So as people get closer to retirement, it's a pretty accurate estimator of how much they might actually get. And again, this assumes that you spend about 5% of your nest egg in retirement with some modest rate of return, some exposure to risk. So the example I gave here is if you think you're going to need $50,000 a year and you go to the Social Security calculator and you realize you're going to get $20,000 from Social Security, you have a gap now of $30,000, so you need 20 times that or $600,000. And you could multiply it by 25 to be a little more conservative and get a slightly bigger estimate in that case. Of course, it depends how long you think you're going to retire, what age you're going to retire, and what kind of challenges you think you might have in retirement. I think the problem with this rule of thumb is it's really hard to think about what your life's going to be like in retirement and what you're going to spend money on. And, some people might assume that their housing costs might go down or up, but they might be off by quite a bit, especially if they need some high cost assisted living. So I think post-retirement, imagining your life post-retirement can actually be quite difficult. As you probably know people who've thought about what their life's going to be in retirement, it turns out to be something quite different. But still, I think what's nice about this rule of thumb, particularly in as a complement to the prior rule of thumb, is it begins to think more about expenses and less just about how much income you make before you retire. Okay, any questions on that? All right, so the next rule of thumb is one that I actually hear a lot, and I'm not sure where it comes from, but the idea is that if you have kids who have some expectation that they're going to go to college and get some support from mom and dad, you're better off to put money into your own retirement and either borrow against your home equity or other sources to help your kids go to school, or just help your kids get student loans and let them borrow for their own education. I think there are lots of other examples, not just kids' education, where this goes forward. The basic thought is that you can't borrow for retirement. You can't borrow money to retire, but you can borrow money for things like kids' education. I think it is true that it is relatively easy to get a student loan, that student loans are relatively low cost and relative to, other loans or relative to what kind of returns you might get in the market. And if you save money in a retirement account, you get compound interest, and so you'd be foolish not to take advantage of that. But I think the flaws with this particular rule of thumb are, one, that it assumes that student loans are always going to be easy and cheap to access, which, student loans are easy and cheap to access primarily because there's a pretty substantial public role in that marketplace. And if we know one thing about the public role in various forms of programs that are out there, it changes with the political winds. And so that may not be a safe assumption going forward. But I think the more important one is there's a study that was done in Maine. I studied another, I can't remember what took place, but it found that when parents even put aside small amounts of money for children's college funds, even if it wasn't enough to pay for more than a year or half a year of school, the kids were more likely to go to school. So part of that is that, that the parents who save for college are probably more educated themselves and probably have more income. And so, it may just be a function of the economic differences between parents who save for college and parents who don't. But even when you, using various social techniques, try to control for that, or you find examples of parents, low-income parents, who were given access to special savings funds, maybe seeded with some special amounts of money, you find that this effect is very persistent. There's something about the communication to a kid that the parents value education enough that they're willing to sacrifice something to do it by putting up money in an account. It sends a message to the kids about the importance of going to college, about attending college. It also essentially lowers the price a little bit for a student. They don't have to borrow as much, and they can think about more options. This is maybe just the community college. They can think about a couple of other places that they could attend too, which may be just slightly more expensive, but now more attainable because they have a little bit of savings there. I'd say the last reason to think about savings for a college fund rather than just borrowing for college, is that there are state tax preferences for the 529 accounts and other sort of forms of college savings. So in Wisconsin, the EdVest program is a very low-cost way to save for save for college education, and also provides some income tax relief for people who use those accounts. So this is a rule of thumb I think brings up a good discussion about trade-offs between our own retirement and our goals for our kids. There are lots of academics who argue about whether we should or shouldn't borrow for education, whether parents should or shouldn't fund education, whether there's some mix of debt and assets. I think that's all an important discussion to have, but for parents, not saving at all for kids' education has a signaling effect, and it's important to think about that over and above any financial effect. And I think the financial effect is also valid, but it's more than just what money is available. It's the message it sends to kids about the expectations about college and the importance of college. Any questions on that one before I go on? All right, so the next one is, there are a lot of these kinds of rules of thumb out there, but these are sort of asset allocation rules of thumb. And this is, most of what we talked about so far is how to save or how much to save, how much your nest egg should be, how much you should be putting away. This one says, once you put it away, what do you do with it? Do you put it into stocks or bonds or under the mattress? What do you do with it? And the basic conundrum that any investor has is, how much risk should I take? And the answer to that is, if you're young, you should take a lot of risk because you have a long time to make up for it. And if you're old, you should take a little risk because you don't have any time to dig out of a hole if you get into one. So one of the most common rules of thumb is to assume that stocks are risky and that bonds are not risky, and that you should put your money into stocks if you can take risk, and you should put your money into bonds if you can't take risk. And so if you imagine where you are 40 years old and you have another 80 years maybe, or no, sorry, another 40 years to ride out any ups and downs in the marketplace, this rule of thumb would say you take 100 minus your age, so 100 minus 40 is 60. You should put 60% of your investments into stocks and the remainder into bonds. And that way, if you do have a rough patch on that 60% that's in stocks, the bonds sort of are still stable and don't lose much value. You can rely on them waiting for the bond, for the stocks to recover over time. There's lots of ways you can implement this. It could be that you, each year, you change your allocation so that it's not that you buy and sell things your whole portfolio every year. It's just that this year, anything I save, I put 60% into stocks and 40% into bonds. And next year, I'll do 59% into stocks and 41% into bonds. Each year, I sort of change that allocation. The other is that you might actually reallocate the whole portfolio. You might just say, I'm going to take all my assets and I'm going to shift them around every year to meet this particular rule, which is also a possibility. This is, a pretty heavy weighting on bonds, frankly, for a 40-year-old to have 40% of their savings in bonds is pretty conservative. That would certainly protect them from downside risks, but it also prevents them from getting the upside risks. The upside potential that might be associated with owning stocks. So I think this is a useful rule, and that it helps people to think about these trade-offs between stocks and bonds, between risks, volatility, and return. It's simple. I mean, most people can do 100 minus their age. Simple. Fewer sick to use. But it's important to note that stocks aren't always, in every period, going to exhibit certain kinds of returns, and the same with bonds. And sometimes bonds even have sort of weaker periods, even though they don't lose a lot of, they still return income, they can lose value. So it's challenging, and I think it's more important to think about how close you are to retirement and then how you could weather a downturn in retirement. Many people might be in retirement and still have 60% of their investments in stocks because they plan to live for 30 years and they, you know, they have plenty of time to wear out to weather any potential losses there. One of the, I think, useful innovations from the financial markets has been something called target date funds, where essentially you can buy a financial product that does this for you. A target date fund would say, okay, I'm going to buy the 2035 target date fund, and so it's assuming that I want to minimize my risk the closer I get to 2035, and it does this reweighting of the portfolio automatically for me. And these are becoming very popular in 401k plans, and there is a lot of merit to this. It's a sort of automatic way to help yourself take on less risk as you get older. Another variation of this we see sometimes is 125 minus your age, not 100. And this would recognize that you might be willing to take more risk in retirement and that you might live to be at a longer age. And it wouldn't assume that you should be 100% in bonds by the time you're 100 years old. So it's a slight variation. But as a rule of thumb, I think the 100 is fine. It, again, it's a conversation starter. It gets people to think about their asset allocation. Any questions on that one? All right, so the last two I have are really not so much rules of thumb, but just slogans. The first is called Save More Tomorrow. It actually is a slogan that was developed by Richard Thaler, who's one of the forefathers of behavioral economics and wrote a book called Nudge that you may have seen on some of the bestseller lists a couple of years ago. His argument was basically that we never want to sacrifice today. It doesn't matter what's dieting or exercise or personal finance. We always want to put it off. We always want to procrastinate. And so we can take advantage of that and say, I'm not willing to save this year, but next year I'm willing to save. And I'm willing to commit myself to save in the future. And one way to do that is, for example, if you think you're going to get a raise next year, I say, I expect to get a 3% raise next year. 2% of that is going to go into savings. I'm not going to take it in my take-home paycheck and put it in savings. And if I can commit to that now, I'm much more likely to do it. He's actually come up with some schemes where you do that with your employer and you commit yourself to that. So you have somebody to enforce that. But, you know, even just personally committing to it or personally and committing to it with other people can put you in that position. And we find that you're more likely to do that. Same with tax refunds. If in December you say, I'm knowing getting a tax refund and I'm going to put half of that away into savings, I will be more likely to put some portion of that into savings. I'm not going to spend it all in advance, which is what oftentimes people do. They say, well, I know I'm getting a $3,000 tax refund, so I may as well go crazy at Christmas time. You know, putting it in writing makes it more real. And obviously, if you have somebody hold you accountable, whether it's somebody in your family or an employer, that can make you get there. I think the key things about this are, you know, really coming up with ways to split the pot. You know, think about ways to give yourself a little bit of reward, but a little bit of future savings, and to maybe not take the pain today, but take the pain tomorrow. And those are just natural human instincts that we can take advantage of and trick ourselves into saving more tomorrow. The next one I list here, again, is more of a slogan. It's about being aware of transitions. Transitions are trigger events, or there's lots of different ways to think about these, but all these rules of thumb, if you followed them, you'd be in pretty good shape, except if something happens, you know, losing a job, moving, getting married, divorce, having more children, a lot of different things can happen in life, healthcare problems. You know, oftentimes this results in a disruption of income and an increase in spending. And this is when people get into trouble. This is when they have trouble making house payments. This is when they tap their retirement funds. This is when they, have to liquidate assets or rack up debt. And, arguably managing transitions is the most important thing that people can do. Insurance certainly helps. Having disability insurance, having life insurance, having homeowners insurance, all these things help. But some of it's behavioral too. And having an emergency fund, for example, can be really important. So that you have, having emergency fund means that you're starting to think about and plan for those emergencies and not get caught off guard. So I think it's an important point to make, that these rules of thumb are useful to a point, but you have to be cognizant of what happens when things don't go well or when these negative trigger events happen. So I'll wrap it up a bit with that and let people have any questions about any of these or other questions just in general about retirement stuff. I know, obviously all of these are just rough rules or rough proxies. We're not taking into account expected lifespan or spouses or housing values or you know, numerous other things that a financial planner might do. But like I said, for a lot of people, these rules of thumb will get them at least thinking about these topics and well on their way towards better retirement planning, better financial planning practices. I think they're a great teaching tool. And, you know, some of this is sort of urban mythology kind of stuff, but it works. And it certainly, I think, as an educational tool, is worth integrating into your work as well. So with that, I'll open it up.
Michael, have you thought about putting some of this material into kind of a news release form to use, or is that something that we could maybe do?
Yeah. Meg and I have been talking a lot about news releases lately. Less on the retirement, more on the dealing with the drop in income. But I think this is one that we've had in the queue for a while and will hopefully get out before too long once we sort of get over the hump on the current events. But that's a great reminder. Thank you for that. Any other questions or comments? I mean, you don't have to just talk about the REIT.
Michael, can you hear me?
Yeah.
This is Nancy Coffey, and I work with very low-income clients. And can you speak just a little bit about even the idea, you know, I think we can get people to understand easily saving for emergencies and paying off credit cards that have high credit ratings. But that whole idea of talking to people who are very limited income about retirement, I find difficult to do in a respectful way. I mean, they all know they should, but when you have so much debt and you're just barely making it, how do you go forward with a conversation like that?
You know, I think for very low-income populations, it's not always a good strategy to save for retirement. I mean, that's a case where repaying off debt and the emergency funds really ought to be the priority. One of the things, and again, this brief is more for a general audience and not for the vulnerable population specifically. Social Security is designed to provide basically a cross subsidy in the system, so that if you earn less and pay less into the system, you actually get relatively more coming out. So the 20 or 30 or 40% income replacement can be larger than that for low-income populations if they have, obviously, on the books work history and get their 40 quarters and all that kind of thing. The other thing about vulnerable populations or low-income populations is that savings can be a detriment if they're trying to apply for certain public benefits. So that makes it all the more complicated to think about retirement savings for this population. I think the new wrinkle in all this is the Savers Credit, which provides some pretty strong incentives, tax incentives for low-income people who have earned income to put money into savings accounts, retirement savings accounts. So that I think does help the proposition a little bit. And the best leverage that I've seen with these populations talking about these topics is if they're lucky enough to have an employer that has an employer match or a 401k, I mean, that's really money on the table. And even, you know, $1,000 that can be put away in a year would be matched dollar for dollar. And it's hard to think of another time when they're going to get that level of support to save. Unfortunately, very few low-income people have jobs that have that particular feature. But it's something to explore with them. But again, I am not somebody who would say save at all costs. For some populations, it should not be the first priority. And I know that is heresy in some circles. You have to be a little more strategic as you talk about people with special needs in those populations. I keep thinking last thing. One more last thing is that oftentimes people's circumstances change, and so when they think about today, it's very difficult to think about saving. But if they're working on schooling, working on gaining more, employment options or more income, or even, marriage or couples when, essentially there's two earners and that helps a little bit. I think there are times that you can get people to think about in the future when things change, I might be able to do this. But that's a really good question.
Thank you. I think that's good. And one of the things that we've talked about as people talk about having enough money for food and the piece of, oops, I probably got too close here, the piece of just taking that tax money that they get back or earned income tax credit money and buying gift cards for gasoline and grocery store gift cards so that, again, they do actually have a kind of a savings there. And yet it's not a savings account that may affect their ability to get other assistance, which you mentioned, and it's very true.
Other questions, comments? Does any of this seem personally useful?
Yes, very much so. Thank you.
Good. Again, it's just a conversation starter, but I hope it's helpful in education settings too, but any further questions, comments? Okay, well, I want to remind people that we have the Lunchtime Learning, our financial series. These calls take place on the second Monday at noon every month. And then Building Bucks, this month is on the 28th, I believe, because the 21st may be our furlough day. I forget the reason why. But typically it would be the following week, but this week it's going to be on the 28th at 1 o'clock. So Building Bucks, this month is about education savings. So it might be a time to talk more about the 529 and other options that exist. And next month we're going to continue to do the financial series. So that call will be, I don't know the date off the top of my head, I don't have the calendar handy, but it'll be was it April 11th? I think it's April 11th. But double check the website to make sure. It should be the same call-in number. But we're going to talk about behavioral economics, which might sound like a dry academic topic, but it's really what I'm spending some time doing is thinking about what the implications are for educators and for people involved in savings initiatives, credit management initiatives, those kinds of things, what the learnings of behavioral economics tell us. So hopefully you'll be able to tune into that. As always, if you have ideas for topics for this series, let me know. And thanks and have a great week.